This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Authoritative text on the diagnosis of mental conditions. Although the DSM classification system has been the focus of public controversy throughout its history, this new manual has generated a level of public revolt unheard of in its history. The reaction to homosexuality as a disorder led to quite a major protest against the DSM in 1970, early 70s. That was part of a broader feminist and anti-psychiatry movement. But the reaction to the new manual includes many of the designers and researchers behind the project itself. Well, Mike, both of us have been under the influence of DSM in various areas of our work, including work in legal and forensic settings. So let's talk today about the implications of this new manual and the whole DSM project and the thinking that guides it for legal decisions. Maybe starting with what has been the progressive aspects of the DSM. Even though it has been guided by psychiatry and it's published by the American Psychiatric Association, that whose coffers are vastly enriched by each new edition, it is a larger project of the mental health field that provides a kind of pass for people to access services. What would we say before we take up the critics? What would we say in its favor about this whole system for looking at people's troubles from your perspective within the law?
Well, it's been phenomenally successful because it supplies a language by which people can talk to each other. It's used by insurance companies to determine who gets paid and who doesn't get paid. Drugs are designed and then are marketed according to the categories it's set up. And it has spread like wildfire since DSM-3, and with DSM-4, it's used every day in courts to determine who gets custody of a child, to determine whether there's any mental defense. And it's particularly used in the death penalty area. Now, the way it's used is not necessarily how its creators intended. A serious criticism of it, in fact, is that it purports to be a medical document. It follows a medical model, but it has no idea how things like depression or bipolar disorder actually are caused. So what it is, it's a collection of symptoms. So
it's what's called a descriptive manual describing symptoms. But a couple editions ago, the whole committee abandoned any notion of agreement on the causes of these symptoms.
Well, they have not a clue. So people like me, if in a death penalty case, will use the fact that, say, bipolar disorder is a collection of 8 different symptoms. And if you have 5 of these 8, you fall into the category of a person suffering from bipolar disorder. So I will ask for money to appoint a psychiatrist. And because my client, I can identify 5 instances of conduct that comport to this particular sort of behavior. And I'll usually get it. Or if I don't get it, I'll have a good reason to complain about lack of due process. So
doesn't this then work against historical prejudices in a way? Or it provides a certain kind, it's a shock absorber in a very ruthless system. So that, for example, historically alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous has fought very hard since throughout its history, particularly since the 50s, to have alcoholism recognized as a disease. And it actually has been one of the more reliable categories over time in terms of agreement among clinicians. Prior to it being adopted within this medical model, it was seen as a sign of degeneracy or a kind of congenital inherited defect of character. And so the shift from degeneracy to disorder was an advance and brought many people out from under the cloak of tremendous shame. And that notion of a disorder implies that there's treatment as well. So it was tied to this idea of a hope for a cure. So is that has it served in these capital cases or in the death penalty cases, has it provided any kind of, has it been a buffer in this sense, or is it represented in advance in buffering the harshness and punitiveness of our criminal justice system?
Well, the medical model, yes, but that's not at all the same thing as the DSM manual. In fact, that led the National Institute of Health to disown the DSM-5. The DSM has been so successful that it has continually expanded and now suffers from what the creators of the DSM-4 call diagnostic inflation.
Some sociologists would say it's a category crisis.
And there is no person on earth who cannot be categorized as disordered under the DSM-5.
Yeah, we went from the first edition, the DSM-1, was published after World War II. These projects are often driven by the expansion of military and the union of military and psychiatry during periods of war. We're little over 100, I think 106 categories, and then each time it's doubled, and we're up to somewhere. It depends on how you define a disorder, because there are subclassifications, 400 or 500 disorders today. And whether that's an advance, the democratizing of madness might be seen as an advance, that everybody has a little, everybody has their own, it's kind of like a boutique designer disorder. There's a little something for everybody here. So it does separate the mad from everyone.
Well, what's happened is that we have had and will have.
It reduces the distance between the mad and everyday people. Go ahead.
Well, it does so much so that it loses all meaning as well. I, as a warrior in the death penalty arena, will use whatever tools are at hand and whatever categories I can.
So don't you have a lot more tools in your toolbox here then?
Well, I can easily imagine a different system of categorization that would also give me other sorts of tools. I think intellectually, and we've had such an inflation that the categories are losing all meaning and all credibility. And there's a real risk here that nobody will give any credence, and I'm talking about judges and jurors, to disorders which are so blatantly universal that they have lost any import. Like the author of the DSM-4, for example, says about the DSM-5, don't buy it, don't use it, don't teach it. There's been 40 times as many people diagnosed with ADHD as 25 years ago. The number of bipolar disorder children has also increased by a factor of 40, far more than anywhere else in the world. There's a systematic expansion that will be incredibly increased for no particular reason that I can see, other than a desire to make this immensely lucrative publishing process bring in yet another huge wave of money to the American Psychiatric Association. And we now have other people's sharks gathering around them as the criticism mounts from a host of different people, from the National Institute of Health, from anti-psychiatry people, from the previous authors of the DSM system. What's happening is that people smell blood and smell opportunity. So we're going to have other diagnostic category books released, I can predict with some confidence.
Yeah, it's kind of like religion in America in many ways. At some point there's a vote in the church too on what constitutes a sin, and at some point after all these field trials and studies, the committee votes on what's a disorder and what isn't. And I think similarly, there are these periods of crisis where you get this incredible entrepreneurial competition for believers.
Exactly.
And I think the level of reaction against the DSM now is itself a symptom of a larger crisis, both within psychiatry and I think within the broader society, about how we manage and think about suffering. One of my critiques that I haven't seen taken up so much in this now, the furor around that's circulating in the internet, is the way in which the manual, even though there are some attempts, quite superficial ones, to locate mental disorders in a cultural context, and they usually have to do culture-bound disorders that are part of, you know, a minority group of some kind, as opposed to the others that are seen as extricatable from culture. But the manual locates a mental disorder in the head of an individual. It is something, it's a bundle of symptoms or traits you carry around with you. And there are ways of thinking about madness or disturbing mental disturbances as relational in a certain way, that two people kind of create a craziness, or two or more people. And I think this is absent here. Does this get taken up in your work?
Well,
how people drive each other crazy.
Well, no, it doesn't. And that's what you're talking about in a way is the placebo effect. Well, it proves precisely that mental illness cannot be located simply in the head. Placebos are notoriously effective for minor to medium depressions. They work at least as well as medication, or in some research studies,
now,
better.
When you talk about placebo, you're talking about an inert substance, but there's a much broader notion of a placebo effect that ties what you're talking about is what accompanies the administration of some kind of help.
Well, of course, and that's why people get better. In every culture in the world, there is a system of healing, and that system involves people of power and influence within that community paying attention to the person who is sick and making moves to improve his or her situation. That has in itself a powerful effect that's abstracted entirely from either the verbal ease used or the particular combination of chemicals in a little pill. It works on its own and at least as well as the medications we've come up with.
And typically there are a set of moving rituals that kind of bring people back into a community or guide people through a transition of some kind. And here, you know, the average psychiatrist spends, I think, something like 7 minutes with the person before a diagnosis is made and a prescription given.
Well, diagnoses are made by any doctor at all, and psychiatric pills have been booming and increasing exponentially without any noticeable effect in the overall mental health level of the United States.
So that would be something to take up on another show as we continue this conversation. What is the role of diagnosis in a good society? What kind of a system would we have? I mean, there are competing models. I think you're right. What we're going to see now is in some ways a reaction from what I think of as more the right or conservative side of the field, where the failure of the DSM to identify neurological or biomarkers of disorders leads for a new approach that's more bound to biology. So an even more intense biologizing
they've
of
not
mental
been able,
suffering.
They have not been able to get anywhere. This simply inaccessible. The efforts to locate within the body the source or the cause of mental problems. And I do hope that the advantages of the concept of disorder within the law remain, the sense that it's not like an alien or a sinful thing. But I'm afraid that the efforts to force a medical model, which have been so completely ineffective, are going to lead to a serious discrediting within the judicial system of any effort to explain why people were compelled to act as they did.
Although in some contexts, in the insanity plea, the definition of insanity is a mental disease or defect that prevents a person from conforming their behavior of the law, and the construct of a disease or defect is used in quite a cavalier and often arbitrary way. So I think challenging up these assumptions in some spheres could be a very good thing. The crisis could have some good outcomes. So let's continue our conversation with the DSM, our review today of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 5th edition, released this week. Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker for The Left and the Law.
A little bit of a change up this morning. It seems that one of the computers in the air room is behaving badly, so we're ad-libbing. And oh, isn't that just the funnest thing ever to do? So that was just Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker reviewing the new DSM-5 and its implications on us all, eventually. Up next, we will have Bill Resnick talking with Nancy Cronick about the state of our information superhighway, libraries, and what we have access to, and the best of times and the worst of times of what we can and cannot read on the internet. Bill and Nancy.
An influential essay in the 90s, striking a claim in cyberspace, ensuring a public place on the information highway. Nancy Cronick, for some time, librarians, with many others, have been concerned that, as you call it, the limitless potentials of the internet and all the new media for free and unhindered access to information, for a diversity of viewpoints, for democratic engagement, that all of those potentials would be lost if private corporate control of the internet and cyberspace continues. You first voiced those concerns in the 1990s. What's changed? What's been lost? What's been gained? What's the picture today?
I think many of us looking back would be surprised to think of a pre-internet world. So we were just talking about what it could be then, and we were getting a peek. So now, probably 15 to 20 years later, we've certainly evolved a lot. We have developed much more capacity to have access like we never knew before. People all over the world today have access, and pretty good access, to resources that were really limited to the most elite and probably buried in libraries that were not even open to the public. So today we have far more access, which is very exciting. But at the same time, we have far more control than we ever had before. So before, a lot of that information was buried in the archives or the stacks of old, musty libraries and archives. But today, a lot of it is out and available for the public, but we have abilities to control that access like never before. So we have the best of times, and we have probably the worst of times.
What about questions of, I guess, what's called net neutrality? When people, for example, make a search and want to learn something, there's only a limited number of 30 or 40, maybe, items that show up on the screen. How do we make sure that those items are not controlled and shaped by profit concerns?
Well, I think we have to realize that access is a very complex idea, and there's many different influences on access. So if you are you're a public library and you have some wonderful digitized resources you want to make available. Now, technically, those resources should be available at the same on the same basis that resources that are put forth by the New York Times. But there's all different kinds of concerns. So, first of all, will they be even picked up by search engines? So, those who are in the corporate sector know very well how to position their content to go high up on those search engines, so they'll get more hits, and those hits actually are what determines their business plan these days. I mean, that's their business model, is instead of selling newspapers, it's based on hits. So, the small nonprofit organizations that do all kinds of interesting work, they're already at a disadvantage because they probably don't have the know-how how to position their content. So that's one thing, is positioning your content. The net neutrality issue is a really interesting one, because what it really is about is whether or not different kinds of providers of information should be given different levels of speed based on what they're willing to pay. And so up until now, we have believed that everybody should have the same level playing field. So the small little public library should have the same access as, say, you know, Netflix has. And there's lots of complications with the problem, and it's not all, you know, the small guy versus the big guy. I mean, in some ways you should say, well, Netflix is using a huge amount of bandwidth and making lots of money. Why shouldn't they pay more than, say, the small nonprofit that has some really valuable content that also needs access? So there's complicated issues here, but the basis is that discrimination should not happen on the providing level, that everybody who provides information should be able to do it neutrally, that your information is not privileged over mine. And as I said, there's lots of concerns about that. Then we have concerns over copyright. Now, since I wrote that article, we've had major, major changes in copyright laws, but we've also had an evolution of the public. It used to be nobody understood copyright except for highly trained copyright lawyers who didn't just have law degrees, but they had sophisticated, advanced degrees in specialties, and that's who dealt with copyright. Nobody else paid attention. Well, today, as we all know, people are concerned about copyright because things like downloading music have become very big areas of tension between teenagers, perhaps, and big content owners. So the fight over copyright is much bigger, but the laws have changed as well. And basically what we saw happen was we have new rules for the digital content than we had in print. So, for example, we no longer have something called the first sale doctrine, which means when you buy a book, a paperback book, you had the rights to do anything you wanted with that book except for sell the rights to it. So you could sell the book, you could destroy the book, you could loan the book in the public library, whatever. Today, with digital, they do not give us those first sale rights. So when you get access to something digital, you don't have a right to do anything more with it, like share it. Or some licenses might say you can share it with your family, like with iTunes. But the limitations now are so much stricter, and the technology exists to actually control that, and not just control what you do with copies, you know, limiting what you can do with copies, but there's also controls that can watch what you're doing with it. So in the old days, you know, if I bought a novel and read it on the beach, nobody necessarily knew I was reading it on the beach unless I was holding up the cover to everybody and saying, look, you know, I'm reading Lady Chatterley's Lover while I'm on the beach. But today, because of the way we compute with cloud computing and the way we license materials, we not only are controlled on what we can do with those copies, but we can actually be watched to make sure what we do with those copies is not only legitimate, but all the information about us using those copies can be collected and aggregated in various ways so that private sector companies can know exactly what our taste is and then market directly to us, but they can also do far more insidious things with us, like put together digital dossiers about us that perhaps might even be shared with the government. Although there's lots of laws to protect the government from gaining that information, we know full well that those laws were modified greatly after 9/11, and many of us are very concerned about not only what the private sector is doing to profile us, to market to us, to sell information about us, but also how much they actually divulge to the government when subpoenaed by the government.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Nancy Cronick about the struggle for free access to cyberspace, and particularly the Internet. Nancy Cronick, let's talk about the various other threats to privacy and many others that corporatization, that if privatization and corporations can succeed, it'll be a huge limit on the possibilities of actual real democratic engagement by ordinary people.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the basic premise here. And that is that in order to participate in a 21st century democracy, people must have access to information and communication technologies. That is the mode by which we disseminate information that is essential to keeping the public well informed so they can participate in their democracy. So let's talk about some of the challenges to that, which I like to call it the commons, how we have this great access to information that we can extract from this amazing resource, but also that we can contribute to. So we've got a society of citizens who are not just gaining information, but they're contributing to that. So it's a very exciting commons that we've got. We've got all these enclosure movements that are keeping that access, perhaps, from happening in the most fundamental ways. And one of them is just the price of access. Who can afford to get onto the Internet and at speeds that are high enough that ensure that you can download? So let me describe what that means. So we think that everybody has access to the Internet. Well, in fact, access to the Internet has not grown very much in this country in the last 10 years, that we've hit a threshold that is not that high, and certain groups in this society are consistently left out. So without everybody even having access to the tools, we have a very unlevel playing field. And if we don't have a level playing field, we have the same problems over and over again, that the elite and the rich and the powerful have lots of access and they actually control information. And those that may not have any of those characteristics, particularly those that tend to be left out of other arenas in our society, minorities, the elderly, children, et cetera, are left really on the slow path or the no path to access, which means they cannot participate in democratic discourse. So we've got issues of access to the technology. And we are not ahead of other countries. We've fallen way behind other countries in the speeds as well as in the high cost. So it's not just the high cost, though. It's what content they have available. So I work in libraries. We spend millions and millions of dollars in libraries to license content. So relevant and valuable content is only available at high cost. Most libraries do not have the money today to spend on these databases. I will tell you, these databases are just enormously expensive. People have no idea how much. You know, you go to the newsstand and you buy a newspaper. But if you're a large library buying newspaper databases, they can cost more than $1 million a year for some libraries, just for one title. And we're talking thousands and thousands of these electronic databases. So we have a digital divide, not just for individuals gaining access, but also a content divide for rich institutions and people who can afford access versus those of us who might only have a small public library in our community or no public library, because there's plenty of communities with no public libraries. So again, it privileges those who can afford, and information is power. in this country, and it's also participation. So it leaves out some of the most important players.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Nancy Cronick. Nancy is a strong, was the president of the American Library Association for a period in the early millennium, and is agitates for a free, open, and democratic internet and all of cyberspace. Nancy Cronick, the struggle for an open internet is not going to be won in the halls of power. It seems to me it's going to be won in the trenches where movements are built. If it is going to be won, it's going to really require popular support. How do you see that problem, and where are we in building those movements?
I think we've got good news and bad news on that front. The good news is, in a highly enclosed world where companies and others have tried hard to control information, we have this just incredible blossoming of open information through such resources as Wikipedia, a good example of a commons where individuals contribute and it becomes a collective resource. And through sort of crowdsourcing techniques that we have pretty accurate information because people evaluate it together, peer review, like we say in the university setting, but it's peer review of the public, and we have just a tremendous development on this front. We have groups like Creative Commons helping people to take control over their own work so that they can make it more publicly available than copyright laws may allow. They have millions and millions of those licenses out there, including my own. I have several works under Creative Commons licenses. So we have a tremendous grassroots effort going. The problem is the people who understand this and do it aren't necessarily organized as a single voice. So how do we get them organized? So Jamie Boyle, who's a law professor at Duke, talked more than 10 years ago about this sort of idea of environmentalism for the net. And several years ago, he proposed the idea of environmentalism for the net. So what he says is, in the 1960s, we had all of these groups that cared about the environment, but we didn't really have the whole idea of the environment. So we had people who cared about water, or we had people who cared about wildlife, or we had people who cared about clean air. But they came together during this move toward a more environmentally sound culture under this whole idea of environmentalism. And so he talks about, can we have that for the net? Can we bring people together to really create pretty much like a coalition or umbrella group of people who care about these ideas of open access and openness on the net? And I think that we're seeing some bright lights there, but it's difficult to organize people because a lot of these people are not organized. So the kid who's downloading music and wants to still be able to have pretty easy access to music that he cares about or she cares about is not really organized in the same way that, say, seniors who belong to AARP who want to get certain things out of the government, perhaps, would be organized or who get certain discounts because they belong. So what's the incentive for all these people to come together? So what's the problem here? Well, for one thing, a lot of these issues don't necessarily, people don't all agree on all the issues. So, for example, I like to say that the publishers and librarians are, you know, really in step when it comes to First Amendment and protecting the rights of people's free speech rights, but they may not agree at all on copyright issues. But both of them are fundamental issues when it comes to an open internet. So a lot of the groups that are already out there that are strong advocates in these arenas don't necessarily agree. And then we have the general public. So we have a situation like we had last year with the SOPA PIPA attempt by Congress to enclose the internet in yet another way related to copyright issues, an attempt to try to better secure the network itself and the content on the network from pirates or those who might hack. And so in trying to do that, there were these bills. One was called SOPA, one was called PIPA. They were attempts to secure content on the internet, but in so doing, they were keeping an eye on what people were doing. And people were so outraged about the privacy implications of the idea of Big Brother watching in order to prosecute those who might violate the law, that there was this mass movement. Millions and millions of people participated in a blackout day on the internet. So while we have this incredible tool, and it can do amazing things sometimes, and we have a lot of investigative journalism going on right now by bloggers, by, you know, independents. Most of our news, most of our action, most of our activism still needs much more mass kind of capabilities, be it mass media capabilities, mass organizing by organized groups. So, you know, we can watch what happened in the last political campaign and how much the net itself contributed. And I think the net is taking more and more of a role in allowing those engaged politically to have this new voice. There's still plenty of money in politics and plenty of money actually controlling what goes on the net as well. So, and whose voice really gets the more privileged places. And then we have the problem of, how does somebody know you're a dog on the internet, as they used to say? You know, how do you know what's true and what's not? We know that things like the president's birth certificate and his religion became great myths that were promoted through the internet. And so the internet doesn't know how to weigh what's true and false. We have to weigh that. And lots of misnomers can travel as fast as facts. True facts. So we've got some real challenges here, and we still need a lot of organizing power. You know, the net doesn't organize us, we organize us. So we still need people to come together and know how to do that. And we're working in a political environment that is very much an environment of rejection of anything. So, you know, the right and the left very often agree on civil liberties issues, on free speech issues, on some of these openness issues, but they don't seem to agree on how to move anything in our legislative policy arena right now. So, you know, sometimes we can just say no. I think a really interesting example was the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement was very compelling and successful, but where is it now? You know, we have to sustain these movements. They can't just be, you know, stop SOPA PIPA or let's draw attention to the abuses of Wall Street. It's how do we really develop a movement that brings people in and keeps them there so that we can keep the pressure on and really use our democratic power that is now much more of a capacity through the internet than we've ever had, but we have to learn how to harness that in a much more successful way.
Those really are important concerns. So, Nancy Kronick, thanks a lot for talking to us, and we'll talk again. This was Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, and Nancy, thank you.
Thank you, Bill. It's my pleasure.
Okay, it's a calm morning out there. Calls for calm music. We just heard Bill Resnick talking with Nancy Kronick about the state of our information superhighway. Very important topic, I think, that affects all of us, if not now, then certainly in the near future. Another change up in scheduling today. Tom Becker has graciously bowed out to allow our movie moles, Jan Hocken and Fran Michel, to have the rest of the show today to discuss The Reluctant Fundamentalist, a new movie by Mira Nair. Movie Moles.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Jan Hocken to discuss The Reluctant Fundamentalist, currently playing in Portland. The film is directed by Mira Nair and based on the best-selling novel by Pakistani author Mohsin Hamid, published in 2007. The movie opens in 2011 in Lahore with the kidnapping of an American professor. A reporter, Bobby Lincoln, played by Liev Schreiber, is sent to interview another professor whom the CIA suspects of terrorist involvement. This character, Chanjaz Khan, played by Riz Ahmed, narrates much of the film in long flashbacks about his earlier life. He graduated from Princeton and went to work for a Wall Street firm as a financial analyst. Under the wing of a boss played by Kiefer Sutherland, Chanjaz excels in finding ways for companies to cut labor costs by cutting jobs. Chanjaz begins dating a wealthy artist, Erica, played by Kate Hudson, and spends some of his new wealth to help pay for his sister's wedding in Lahore because their father, a poet, can't afford the sort of celebration their mother wants. But on a business trip to the Philippines in 2001, he watches the Twin Towers fall, and on the way back to New York, is subjected to a strip search at the airport. Though he continues to succeed at work, Chanjaz increasingly faces hostility from the Americans around him, and is especially disillusioned when Erica's latest art show turns out to involve a fetishizing display of their relationship. Asked to shut down an unprofitable Turkish publishing company that had translated his father's poetry, Chanjaz quits instead and returns to Pakistan, where he becomes a popular teacher and a person of interest in the kidnapping that opens the film. So, Jan, other reviewers don't seem to have liked this movie as much as we did.
And we were surprised by the harsh reactions of many that we would expect to support a political film, a refreshing break from the Hollywood vacuous blockbusters that are bludgeoning our sentences each week. But one criticism is that the film relies too heavily on stereotypes of good guys and bad guys, with Pakistanis kind of romantically cast as virtuous and part of a much richer, more sensuous, inviting culture, and Americans as uniformly stupid, sadistic, or insensitive. Although this criticism of the stereotypes of America does not generate the same outrage in relation to other American films that hideously stereotype other groups, such as Argo, which generate enormous fanship, even though it presents a very violent, massified view of Iranian society. So the question is why this reaction to it? And then there's, I think, related to this notion that it's as a simplistic critique of capitalism, that the comparison of the fundamentals of capitalism as a form of fundamentalism and fundamentalist Islam seems irresponsible for some critics.
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, some people have said that the parallels the film draws between Islam and capitalism as two forms of fundamentalism, which is quite explicit in the film. On the one hand, some viewers have said, well, that's too simplistic. And some have said, well, it's old news. We know that capitalism is bad after the 2008 collapse. But I think...
As though these are easy targets.
These are easy targets, which I think is not the case. And nobody seems to talk about the grounds on which that parallel is drawn in the film, which is that both terrorist Islam fighting for its political goals and capitalist business seeking greater profits seek their goals without any regard for the harm that it causes to people, that it has consequences for people who are far away from those making plans, that it destroys lives without considering the effects of that. And I think that that's a really important critique that doesn't get addressed in some of the reviews that in any of the reviews that we've seen. And I think is a valid critique that in fact we do see in this film what we don't see very often, the fact that capitalism does have quite negative consequences for people. I mean, Chanjaz in the beginning of the film, in the parts where he's going out and finding ways to cut costs, even when they've already reduced their labor costs because people are getting $5 a day or a dollar a day. Well, you can get rid of some of those workers even as low as their wages already are.
And he's seen as having a certain kind of genius for this skill of cutting fat from the bone of companies.
Yeah. And he's very successful at that.
But I think there is a a line of criticism that I found somewhat compelling, that his conversion from a wholehearted traitor who seemed to not have any conflict about what he was doing, even when the misery was right in front of him, even when he was visiting these places and confronted by his own father with the amorality and immorality of what he was doing. He was unfazed by it, and then he turns on it and walks away from it. And some would say it's kind of doesn't tell you enough about the conversion.
I would disagree with that. I mean, there is, as you say, there's a scene at his sister's wedding when there's a conflict with some of the servers who are bringing out the food, and somebody is going to get fired because he forgot to do something he was supposed to do. And Chanjez he's upset that this poor guy is going to get fired for making some minor mistake, and he is about to intervene, and his father sort of gives him a talking to about the fact that, well, you care about this one person's job, but what about all the jobs that you're destroying in the work that you do? And Chanjez he's given money for the wedding to his mother in secret, without having promised not to tell his dad,
to protect the father's ego,
and he can't stop himself, and said, "Well, I paid." You know, he's sort of it fesses up that he has helped pay for the wedding, because it's sort of affecting his ego. But I mean, there's there are those kinds of confrontations with his family. There's also all of the scenes of his harassment by the TSA, by police in New York, the looks and comments he starts getting from coworkers, the difficulties he starts having in his daily life. There's the conflict with his girlfriend, which is a pretty big blow up we might talk about also. And then finally, there's this conversation he has with the Turkish publisher.
That seemed to be a pivotal turning scene. It also relates to the father's son. That was a slip of the father's son relationship, and how the legacy of the father is transmitted to the son. Maybe we could talk a bit about that, where he's accused by this publisher of being a janissary. We should probably say what a janissary is. Well, it's somewhat mythologized, but a practice that was thought to be part of the Ottoman Empire, where young boys were brought in, and because they were separated from their kinship group, they were particularly vulnerable to being trained and taught an identity as part of the Ottoman Empire soldiers, and did not have conflicting loyalties to kinship, but to empire. And capitalism, in a certain sense, could be seen in that sense, because people are disconnected from their roots around the world and then become kind of mercenaries in a certain sense. So that seemed to be a pivotal sense, and raises the question of, is capitalism a kind of based on that janissary principle?
Yes. And it does seem to, we see it's a fairly multicultural workforce in this Wall Street company. One of his coworkers is Chanjez's coworkers is played by Nelson Ellis of True Blood fame, Lafayette on True Blood. And I mean, it's quite a diverse workforce, and it's sort of the multicultural face of neoliberalism now, of multinational capitalism. And I think we do get a sense that those from the outside are brought in, both within the U.S. and the case that the publisher is making, that he's been, his allegiances have been corrupted. He's been won over to the other side and become a soldier for the opposition. But I think that in terms of his transformation, it's the cumulative effect of all of these things that shapes his change of heart and his decision to finally quit his job. I think it is set up, I think, effectively.
It's true to life in that way, and that there isn't necessarily one precipitating, precisive moment, as often you see in films, where the plot turns,
yeah,
and the characters transformed.
But there are, I think, some very effective scenes in the course of this movie.
This is Jan Hawken and Fran Michel talking this morning about the film by Mira Nair, The Reluctant Fundamentalist,
currently playing in Portland. You're listening to The Movie Moles on KBOO, 90.7 FM in Portland. And we're talking about The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which is not really about religion at all. It is about sort of fundamentalism in other kind of ideological ways. And it does put in opposition to that a kind of liberal humanism that a very rare review has objected that the film is too soft on the U.S., that it doesn't, for instance, mention the U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan that might have been motive for the kidnapping of that professor who turns out to be working for the CIA. No big surprise there. And yet, even within this sort of liberal humanist frame, we are getting a critique of capitalism. We are getting a sense of the events of 9/11 from those impacted by this, are you with us or against us, kind of dichotomy that gets set up at that point, particularly in American rhetoric. So I think that all of those things do cumulatively in the course of the film shape the character's development. And
yeah, and he poses a question that is somewhat a rhetorical one posed to the audience, saying, well, what is our dream of development now? He says to these Pakistani students. And he said, I don't put immigration to America as on the list. Let's take that one off. What is our vision? And, you know, it's just kind of the moral bankruptcy of the American dream as he realizes it is at the center of the story, and in a way that I think does invite reflection on capitalism as a global system, not only the American dream.
Yeah.
And its poverty.
Yeah. And there are moments of humor in the film. There are exciting chase scenes that are not my favorite thing about movies, but they work well enough, and it's certainly gripping and engaging all the way through.
Yeah, and there are wonderful love scenes, although there's more to be said about the girlfriend. As a woman director, the women are treated quite harshly in this film in a certain way. They're very marginal. In some cases, quite hideous.
It is a father-son film.
Very
in
much
lots
so.
Of ways. A son with many fathers and questions about which ones he's going to honor.
Yeah. And Nair was apparently her father's son.
Yes.
She was dedicated to her father at the end.
It's dedicated
She's been
to her
quite
father,
accomplished.
Who was from Lahore himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And had left before the partition.
That'd be interesting to know that story.
For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel and Jan Hocken discussing The Reluctant Fundamentalist, directed by Mira Nair and playing in Portland. Go see it.
Okay, we've been listening to Jerry Mulligan there, in case you were wondering what this music has been today. And before that, we heard Jan Hocken and Fran Michel discussing The Reluctant Fundamentalist, a movie out. I believe it's playing in Portland, so go see it, like Fran said. I think this pretty much wraps it up for today. I want to thank those of you who called in about the sound difficulties we had during Bill's interview. Hope we got that rectified for you as best as we can or could. And thank you for your patience this morning with the technical difficulties we've been having with the show. We always appreciate people calling in, and we always appreciate listeners. And it's community radio, and with technical difficulties, the more support we have from members and the listening audience, the fewer technical difficulties we will have with better equipment. Anyway, plug for the show, plug for the station, listen, and if you want to hear us again or any part of the Old Mole Variety Hour, you can like us on Facebook. And tell your friends. You can leave a comment, and we hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO, at 10, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we hear an interview with professor and author Michael Clare about the arms pouring into Syria from Russia. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus on keeping GMOs from spreading in the Willamette Valley. As GMO wheat goes rogue in Oregon, she presents another interview with food activist Clinton Lindsay. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman interviews Temple Grandin about her new book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, host Will Hall interviews Gary Greenberg, practicing psychotherapist and author of The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Clare, who's a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, The Cold War Redux. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Pleasure to be back with you.
We're getting some pretty depressing news out of Syria now with the Russians doubling down on arms sales, and they've just announced that they're going to be selling advanced MiG fighters along with these S-300 anti-aircraft missiles that they've threatened to deliver. And also, of course, in the United Nations Security Council on Saturday, Russia blocked a declaration by the Security Council, which would have otherwise passed, expressing grave concerns about the situation in the town of Al-Qusair that's being fought over by Hezbollah and the rebels at the moment, where up to 50,000 civilians are trapped and may well be massacred. So it's pretty cynical on the part of the Russians, but you're suggesting that if this continues on the way it's heading, there's going to be a new kind of Cold War-like arms race emerging?
I think something like this has been emerging over the past few months, in the past year or so, sort of not visible exactly, but developing nonetheless. I think it's evident in the arms sales that are underway and in the reaction of China, especially in Russia, to the Pacific pivot that President Obama announced. I think the Pacific pivot is a trigger for a lot of this. This is the policy of the U.S. shifting its priority to the Pacific Ocean and putting China on the defensive. This has pushed China closer to Russia, and I think the two of them now see themselves in a kind of Cold War-like struggle with the United States for power and influence in Greater Eurasia. So one thing leads to another. It's hard to pin down who's started it all. Like the first Cold War, you can't pin it down. But one thing leads to another, and now Syria is the center of all this.
Well, we know that the president and the new Chinese premier are meeting next weekend in California for a get-together that involves their wives and lots of golf, I imagine. But obviously, with China's growing economy, whether China becomes more militaristic or not, the percentage of their defense budget will automatically go up shortly as the GDP of China rises, which it has been doing at a rather spectacular rate.
Absolutely. And they have announced further increases in their defense spending in recent months. A lot of this focused on the Navy, and not surprisingly the Navy, because this is where the main axis of confrontation with the United States is taking place, in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And there have been recent comments from China that they see the United States on a course of containment, and the United States acting in a more belligerent manner in the Pacific, and they're going to respond in kind. This will lead to a naval buildup, and I fear a naval arms race. And we just heard in the past few months that China is on its way to buying new submarines from Russia and buying advanced aircraft from Russia. This was when President Xi Jinping made his first trip abroad to Moscow in March or April, where he met with Vladimir Putin, and they apparently agreed to billions of dollars in new Russian arms transfers to China. So you see how all of this is linked together.
And in terms of Russia's arms sales to the Assad dictatorship, and Iran, of course, is joining in, and Hezbollah actually have fighters on the ground fighting in this key battle. There is no question that there's a resolve on the part of the Russians, whether it's for geopolitical reasons or just pure cynicism. They are serious, but the West doesn't seem to be quite sure about what to do. The U.S. has been ambivalent from day one about arming the rebels, and the Saudis and the Qataris are pouring arms into the worst elements in the Syrian opposition, the fundamentalist Salafists. So how do you see this Cold War developing out of the situation in Syria, given that Russia's determined to pour as many arms in as they can to ensure Assad's victory, but the United States doesn't